This podcast was made possible by a sponsorship from AveXis, a clinical stage gene therapy company. The following content was not developed by AveXis.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 43. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining us today is Jeff Olander from Raleigh, North Carolina. Jeff and I actually go way back. We were in a power hockey league together when I was a kid. And I think, Jeff, you were in, I want to say, high school maybe around that time. I can't remember exactly, but that sounds right. Okay, yeah. And so Jeff is now a PhD student at UNC Chapel Hill studying physics. So we are really glad to have him on board today. I actually just ran into Jeff this weekend at an SMA fundraiser, and we were catching up and invited him on the show. So, Jeff, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin.
Absolutely. Well, before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
Are you interested in understanding gene therapy? ExploreGeneTherapy.com has helpful information about gene therapy, including its history and how it is being investigated for the treatment of genetic diseases. Visit www.exploregenetherapy.com.
All right. Well, Jeff, as I said, you know, you and I go way back, and so I'm pretty familiar with your story. But for our listeners out there, can you just tell us a little bit about your backstory and when you were diagnosed with SMA, and also just a little bit about your family life?
Sure. So I was diagnosed at 18 months. So I have lived my whole life with SMA. Actually, I also have a younger brother. He has SMA. He was diagnosed at a very young age also. We grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina. Our parents were always very focused on our care and also ensuring that we had a relatively normal life in spite of the physical limitations that come with being in a wheelchair, having limited strength, mobility. I had spinal fusion and rod when I was 7, and that helped quite a bit. And then over the years, I had a surgery to place a G-tube, and also I at night with a BiPAP, and from what I've read over the years, these are the kind of things that are recommended for people with SMA to do. And we didn't necessarily have that guidance back when it was real time for us, but it's good to see that we did take the right action. And it's a big reason why I'm able to be here today talking with you.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up technologies like that. So did you and Austin, which for listeners, Austin is Jeff's younger brother, did you and Austin both use the BiPAP and similar technologies?
Yeah, so he got a lot of those surgeries and technologies before I did. He had a little bit more difficulty when he was young, so he started on the BiPAP and the feeder when he was around 5 or 6. I didn't end up on those assistant devices until I was in high school. So it was that I was able to take care of my own feeding. Although I probably had sleep apnea for a while before I ended up with the BiPAP, I was able to sleep the whole night without much trouble. But then again, as the years went on, it became progressively more of an issue with getting restful sleep, not having problems with secretion, congestion, and so eventually I did start wearing a BiPAP.
Sure, sure. And, you know, it's funny because I remember back in those days, like, you know, just in terms of how the BiPAP machine has evolved a lot, I'm sure they were much more uncomfortable for you back then, like they were for me, because they've evolved so much since then, and, you know, they make them a lot smaller. But that's why I always hated wearing those when I was a kid, because it looked like a full Darth Vader mask on you. And now they make them so that they're like these really nice small nose pieces, and I much prefer those.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I think has, as with a lot of technology that I have co-opted to assist me in my daily life, I think what's really essential is that technology was either first in the mainstream or it entered the mainstream at some point, because it's only when lots of people use something that gets refined, you know, more user-friendly, more stylish. And so I think that with all of the awareness of sleep disorders that have come up in my lifetime, certainly a lot more people are treating their sleep apnea with devices like BiPAPs or CPAPs, regardless of whether they have other disabilities.
Right, right. That's a great point. And you know, I'm really excited to talk in a little bit about how that ties into your career and what you want to do in terms of developing technologies like that. So we will get to that in just a little bit. But on this note of, you know, growing up, and, you know, you talked about the technologies and how those kind of evolved, and just in the time when you were a kid and then when Austin came along. One of the things, too, I'm curious about is, like, when you were growing up in school and you got to be kind of the guinea pig, you know, for your family, were there things that you and your parents learned when you started school and that kind of thing that helped by the time Austin got to school?
Well, yeah, I think certainly that was the case for a lot of what I went through, because we did go to the same schools over the years. And so arrangements that I made when I went through, you know, people remembered or it was documented, and so they were able to do that for Austin as well. As far as specific things that were done, of course, you know, if you're in public school and you have a disability, you are an individual evaluation plan, or IEP,
right,
is used to set forth what your needs are, what kind of assistance and technology you require. And that helps, you know, that follows you throughout your public school career. And so that's an important document, an important aspect of going to school with a disability, is making sure that there's sufficient documentation of your needs and what the system can do to make your school career successful.
Definitely. And Jeff, I'm really glad you brought that point up, because, you know, IEPs are such a big deal. And I think, you know, there are a lot of parents today who, when they get their kids with SMA or other disabilities to school, you know, it's kind of a crazy process and they don't always know where to start. What was your experience like in terms of getting the proper accommodations? And, you know, is there anything you learned that you want to pass on to generations now, maybe?
Well, you know, when I started, I was just a kid, and I was only focused on what kids care about. So a lot of that was handled by my parents at first.
Sure.
And over the years, especially as I entered high school and then college, what defined sort of the maturing process for me, or the coming of age process, a lot of that was taking on the responsibilities that up to that point my parents had taken on. Unfortunately, when I was 18, we suffered a real loss. My dad died of cancer, and so that was he was one of the two people that were helping take care of me in Austin. And so it was a moment where I had to really step up, so to speak, and take on a lot more of the management and the responsibility for not just my care, but also for my brothers, who Austin was still underage at the time. And also, one thing that we have to remember is to be mindful of what our caregivers, specifically, of course, our parents, are able to do. And that's been something that's an ongoing thing that I have to think about, is how much is my mom able to do as she's getting older, and I have to adapt my routine as necessary to fit with our changing abilities, all three of us.
Right. Well, and Jeff, I remember when your father passed away, and still my condolences. I can't imagine how difficult that transition was, and it was hard enough for me, for any adult SMA trying to figure all that out. But I can't imagine the difficulties on top of that. But when you did have to make that transition and start looking for caregivers outside of your family, what were those initial steps like?
Well, again, a lot of this predated that event, because both of my parents, they worked full-time jobs. And so throughout our school careers, once we got home, my parents were not at home.
Okay.
And so we had to have somebody there to help me and Austin out. From the time we got home on the bus until our parents arrived. So for, 18 years or so, that was the setup. We had somebody in the afternoon who would stay 4 or so hours with us. And so from a very young age, both Austin and I had to learn how to work with people. Well, of course, we had assistance at school as well.
Right.
So, from a very young age, we had to become conscientious of what it's like when you're with somebody all the time. And that was something that then translated over when we left high school and went to college. Of course, the big difference then was that the school system no longer provided the assistance. We had to find our own assistance. And fortunately, we didn't have to pay for that assistance totally out of pocket. But still, we had to do the hiring, do the training, orientation, all of that ourselves. But as I said, that was something that Austin and I had to go through for years before, because we had somebody after school for watching.
Sure. And I'm glad you said that, because I wasn't really sure what you guys had done growing up. So that's good to know. And in terms of when you started hiring caregivers yourself, what was that like in terms of, going through candidates and asking the questions and trying to find the right people?
Yeah, well, I wish that I had the magic formula for hiring the perfect caregiver. But, I've been doing this, I've been doing it myself for, 14 years or so, and then I've been party to it for years before that, and I can tell you, you do pick up an intuition, but frankly, the process never gets easier, because, you know, that when you have to transition from one person to another, well, there's a lot that person had to come to understand about your routine, and so that's a lot of knowledge that you then have lost and have to somehow you have to teach somebody else all of the same considerations. And as you know, when you live with a disease that is purely a physical disease, and so you're mentally as sharp as anybody, it can be very psychologically and emotionally challenging, just because you're fully aware of what's at stake. And I wish I could say it's easier. As I said, there are a few things that I would classify as intuition that you pick up over the years. So the process that we use currently is to put an ad on Craigslist for an assistant. And this year I tried something new. I also put the ad on Indeed.com.
Sorry, can you repeat that site?
Sure, yeah, Indeed.
Indeed, got it.
Yeah, and so I tried that this year for the first time because we were finding that the response rate on Craigslist has really dropped off over the years. And again, there's no magic formula. All I can say is you have to keep trying different approaches and be willing to put in the time. The last person that we hired to help us, it was 2 months after the previous person had left, and we were searching that whole time. But what we found is if you can make do with a short staff for the interim, that's a preferred approach to hiring off the cuff, hiring somebody immediately who may not be the right person. It's better to take the time and look for the right person if you can afford to do that. And I realize that would be entirely dependent on what your other care structure is like, but that's what we, as much as we're able to do that, that is our philosophy.
Oh, I think you nailed it there. It, like you said, it's something that is always going to be challenging, but that's really cool to see how, and I think especially with you and Austin both kind of working together on this, the things you've picked up along the years and how you managed. But that's really interesting about the Craigslist thing too, because I do hear, I've mainly gone through agencies, but that's interesting to see that it's been a little bit of a drop-off rate there. So trying other sites, so that's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've tried agencies in the past. I think, when we were talking, you and me, yesterday, and you said how you were able to get friends to help you during the day while you were at college, and I don't know, I'm sure there were lots of reasons for you to do that. One thing that Austin and I have found is that you really have to find a special type of person to accompany you out into your academic and other pursuits. You have to have someone who's a really good problem solver, but who's also able to fit in to the environment. And so I know what we've found is if you're in a college environment, it really pays to have an assistant who has some college experience. And so that's something that you really can't be selective about when you go to an agency, right? And so, you know, we just figured out the best way for us to get that kind of person is to search for ourselves. And as you say, sometimes it's easier to have someone else to do it, but then, as I was saying earlier, our philosophy is if you can afford to take the time and put in the effort, it pays dividends, you know, by finding just the right person. And of course, we don't get it right every time, but I'd say our success rate is pretty good. Usually when we hire somebody, we're able to hold on to that person for a year or a couple of years. And again, it's just partly looking at the candidate on an individual basis, but also you just get a feeling, you know, is this going to be a person that will understand what our life is like, who will be able to step in relatively seamlessly and fit with our dynamic. And that's a huge consideration.
Oh, that's a great point. I think, you know, personality is a huge factor, I think, when choosing a caregiver. You know, I think sometimes it is, you know, you're limited, and you know, sometimes you just need someone, you know, to get you up on a Saturday morning or something like that. But like you said, when it's someone who's going to be out and about with you and, you know, with you a lot of time, I think, yeah, absolutely, that personality is a big factor to take into consideration. So thanks for pointing that out. And Jeff, shifting gears just a little bit. So, you know, we've talked a little bit about your academics and what you're doing now, but I wanted to expand on that. And so I know you and Austin have always been really big into academics. And I think we've joked before that you're basically career students, you know. But can you talk about, your interests and how they led into your career path? And then, you know, just kind of go through what you did from undergrad to grad school and et cetera.
Yeah, sure. So I think I always knew that my future was going to be very closely tied with academics. And for justification, all I can say is that my family, we've always said that one thing that you can do sitting on your butt is think. And in the academic world, your brain and the ability to think is what defines success. So I'd say that, you know, that roughly is a guiding philosophy. That's why we've stuck with academics as long as we have. Personally, I'm very physically, mechanically minded. I've always had a fascination with science and engineering. When I went to college, I went to NC State as an undergrad, and I started out as a mathematics major, as I loved math, and I thought maybe I would teach math. But then I took a couple of physics classes and discovered that, well, that's really more where my passion lies, and I think it's because you can take the very almost theoretical principles of math and then apply them practically to the real world. And I'd say that over the course of my college career, I've tended more towards the practical or the engineering side. So right now, as you said, I'm getting my PhD at Chapel Hill. My focus is in fluid dynamics. So I study a particular problem that looks at the way the fluids pass next to each other in a particular geometry. And while that's interesting, and I do enjoy solving those problems, I'd say in the last handful of years, I realized that my talents could be put somewhere else, more specific to my life. And as I said, I've always been very engineering-minded, and so in the last few years, I realized that what I'd like to do after I get my degree is go into some kind of engineering field where I'll be able to work on devices that will assist people with disabilities. And so specifically, I'm interested in devices that will help people like me with motor limitations to access more of their environment. So in my next phase of my career, I'm hoping that it will involve some kind of lab where I can design devices that people can put on their wheelchairs or have in their home that will be intelligent, more than just things that are thrown together, but things that are actually designed with the end user in mind, and that are intelligent enough to meet their needs.
Oh, I think that's great. And hey, maybe you can come work for Canova Robotics, which is the company that makes my Jayco arm. That'd be pretty sweet.
Right, right. So one thing that I have to say, you know, I know there are a lot of companies out there that offer technologies, and some of them, as you say, you use the Jayco arm, they're really sophisticated, and They're very useful devices for some people. I tried the Jayco arm, as I think I told you yesterday.
Right.
And it didn't quite work for me. And I think that sometimes you have to go back to basics. And although an external device like the Jayco arm is easy to engineer as opposed to something that would interface directly with a person, like something that would go on their body, unfortunately, I think that's also a limitation, because when you're faced with a challenge, as you know, every challenge is unique to the person facing it. And so I think that technology needs to focus more on being adaptive, not only to the environment, but to the individual. And so that's sort of why I'd like to go into initially a research type field, because I think there's still some need for development of these technologies. I don't think they're ready for prime time yet. That's what I'm interested in.
Oh, that's great. And, you know, I'm glad you said that, too, because, you know, I think a lot of companies, they have great mindsets and they want to develop technologies that are practical. But the best people to consult about these things are people like you and me who know the specifics of, like, what people with SMA can and can't do. And again, SMA is such an individualized disease that, you know, like, I can use a Jayco arm, you had trouble with it. And those are things that companies need to know, that, like, the same setup is not going to work for everyone. And there needs to be accommodations and modifications to devices like that, you know?
Right, right. So one thing that I am also really interested in now is the upsurge in maker spaces. So I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I'm not.
Concept. So in recent years, and a lot of this has been centered around higher education institutions like universities, but it's the idea of a space that's open to people within the community to come in and design and create some relatively sophisticated technologies, or, you know, that can even be artistic creation. But they're spaces that have sophisticated equipment like 3D printers or laser cutters that are open to members of that community to come in and use. And it, you know, it's a very accessible way to design and create things without, you know, having the upfront expense of, you know, buying the technology yourself. So that's what I'm really interested in. And in fact, my part-time job currently is working at the makerspace at Chapel Hill. They call it BEAM, B-E-A-M, and that stands for Be a Maker.
Wait, say that one more time.
Sure. BEAM, and BEAM is what we call ourselves, and that stands for Be a Maker.
That's really cool. Be a Maker. I like it.
Yeah. And again, that kind of proactive, can-do attitude is what we encourage in our spaces, and it's what I love about working there, because again, you're able to create relatively sophisticated designs and then realize them in you know, three dimensions, print them out on a 3D printer, and suddenly you have a cup holder that you designed perfectly from scratch. And it is exactly what you need because you designed it, and here it is in front of you, and now you can use it. And so, you know, that kind of access, I think, is going to be an essential part of this growing access to individualized assistive technology. Because at some point, you know, we're going to have to rely on the people with the disability or their immediate caregivers. We're going to have to rely on all of their years of experience to inform where the technology needs to go. And so that's something that having these accessible spaces where people can come in and get consultations on design, that's why they're so essential, because they allow that connection between the experience of the person with the disability and the design that otherwise would be left up to companies or designers that, let's face it, are not often those who use it.
That's great. No, I really wasn't familiar with that, so I'm glad you shared that. And Jeff, these makerspaces, are they just things you see at universities, or do they appear in, like, corporations as well?
The ones I'm familiar with are at schools, so universities, even some public schools and private schools at the high school level. I've heard they've opened up makerspaces. I think that Enlo has a small makerspace. You know, other area schools I've heard, of course, the North Carolina School of Science and Math, they have a makerspace. So it's, you know, not limited to universities, but certainly, again, the technology is prohibitively expensive for the individual. And so it only is affordable at the institutional level, you know, unless you've already got some extra money to put towards it. But again, if you're somebody who, you know, if you're a child, or if you are a young adult who otherwise would not have access to this technology, this is a great way to give that access.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. And it's funny you mentioned Enlo there. That's where I went to high school. So go Eagles. That's pretty cool. But
right.
That's really cool. Well, Jeff, that's, you know, that's fascinating information, and thank you for sharing. And I, you know, wish you best, of course, on your finishing up PhD and then going into your career. Just a couple more things. So, shifting gears, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday at the fundraiser, but I am curious. I know you're on Spinraza, and if you want to just talk a little bit about that and what your experience has been like and where you are in that process.
Sure. So my brother and I started on Spinraza at the end of this spring. So I think we had our first injection in May. And as those of your listeners who are familiar with the cycle, you get a few doses in close succession, so like every week or every 2 weeks initially, and then eventually they spread out to every 4 months. And so my next dose is in November. I had my last dose in, I guess, July. So I'm now on the maintenance part of the dosing. As far as the process goes, you know, initially it was a little bit much just because we had to go in, you know, first it was once a week, then once every 2 weeks, and we have to get these done at Duke because that's the only place around here that offers those injections, and we live in Raleigh, so that's always a trip to make it up to Duke. And but otherwise, you know, once we're there, there's a little bit of a wait, but of course the procedure itself doesn't take very long. You're put on the table that they use for the CT machine, and the radiologist places the needle inside your spinal fluid. You're lying on your side, and you're fully alert. There's the only anesthesia is a locally applied right where they're going to put the needle. And so they push in the needle. It's usually relatively, I'd say fairly painless. It's also something that on a couple of occasions I wasn't really aware that it was in until they told me, oh, it's in. So it's a fairly low stress procedure. And then the neurologist comes in with the Spinraza, administers it, and then that's it. They want to monitor you for like an hour afterwards just to make sure there's no complications, but it's a fairly straightforward process.
Right, right. Well, and Jeff, I'm curious because you and I are both type 2 and we've had spinal fusion surgery. So as listeners know, I get mine through cervical injections because they weren't able to find a place in my spine to put the needle in. And so it's interesting you still do the spinal method. Do you have any kind of, like, are you able to do just a standard spinal injection, or did you have to try any kind of alternative methods when you were starting out?
It was relatively straightforward for us. They place the needle under radioscopic guidance. You know, we're inside
right. The
CT machine, so they're able to look in and see where the spine is and see where the rods are. I didn't have any problem. Austin was also relatively straightforward. I think at first they had the wiggle around a little bit just to find an opening that they could put the needle in. But, we have been able to get the usual placement.
That's really interesting, yeah. No, it really varies person to person, as does, you know, most things with SMA. But But that's really good, and I'm glad it's they've been really smooth for you. And on that note, I know you've just had 5 injections, but have you seen any changes or noticed anything since you started the process?
No, not really. I haven't been reassessed. I did ask about that, and before we started on this, they went through a function assessment. I had a pulmonary function test, a other ability function test, and so it'll be interesting. I'm especially interested in the pulmonary test to see if I've made any improvements in my respiratory stress. Anecdotally, I don't feel all that different, but... Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Sorry, my headset just died.
Oh, no worries. I can still hear you, though.
All right, so, anecdotally, I haven't noticed much change, but, again, I'm hoping that will be different eventually.
Sure, yeah, I mean... I think some of them just take longer than others, and some changes and advances are more subtle than others, so you never know. But yeah, thank you for sharing, and I wish you the best, on future injections as well. So, well, Jeff, wrapping up here a little bit, I just wanted to get on a couple more things real quick. First off, I know you've talked about your career and everything, kind of what you're doing now. Can you just give listeners an idea of what your daily life looks like these days and, just a typical day of the week, what that kind of looks like for you?
Yeah, sure. So I'd say most of my days really hinge on the nights. So at night, both Austin and I have 12 hours of licensed nursing or skilled level nursing. And again, this is because our mom is not able to do the physical aspects of our care. And so we have to have somebody with us during the night to monitor our BiPAPs. We get feedings during the night. And so really, a lot of what happens during the day is contingent on how successful was the night. And so on a normal, every day when we have full coverage and our nights are good, during the day, I try to get over to my lab at UNC to work on my dissertation, but also, as I said, I work part-time at the makerspace, so some days I'm over there. On other days, I'm just at home because maybe I've got some errands to run or other obligations.
No worries.
On other days I'm doing errands or other obligations, of course. As part of the daily care, I have to allot time for bathrooming, for eating, because although I do get a feeding at night, I still enjoy eating by mouth. And so, although I'm not, I'm sort of provisionally able to feed myself. If I'm set up at my house, I have a particular setup that I use to eat. And when I'm set up at the house, I'm able to feed myself. But if I'm anywhere else, if I'm out at work, or if I'm out at just out somewhere, I do have to have someone feed me. And yeah, so again, I don't know if there's an average day. It's sort of whatever challenges need to be addressed for that day. We take it as it comes.
Absolutely. Well, and I think that leads into my final question here, which is, Jeff, do you have any advice for people out there? I know you touched on advice on caregivers and that kind of thing, but just any general life advice for either other people with SMA or just anyone in the SMA community based on your experiences?
Well, I guess the thing that I try to live by is to find those aspects of life that make me happy, that give me fulfillment, and, you know, it's not always possible to achieve those, but in whatever way I can, I try to, because there's plenty of heartache, plenty of difficulty, plenty of hard days that are naturally going to come to you when you have a disability like us. And so you just have to consciously make every effort you can to seek out what makes you happy, to put some energy into that, whatever energy you're able to afford. Take time and think about it, because you know, it's a cliche, but life is too short to waste on just getting caught up in all of the minutia and the struggle of living a life with a physical disability. As it is very possible to just focus entirely on surviving, but really, that's not worth it to me. To me, you have to find some purpose for yourself.
Oh, I think that's great, Jeff. I really appreciate that. Well, again, Jeff, I really thank you for coming on today. I think this was great, and I'm glad we got to catch up yesterday at the fundraiser. And this is a really great conversation. So, absolutely. Well, is there anywhere people can find you, or maybe if you have your dissertation coming out, where people can look for that?
I'm not sure about that, but for just contacting me, I'm on Facebook. You can look me up there. That's probably the best way to reach out to me. And of course, if anybody contacts you and is interested in talking, I'm more than happy to have you share my contact details with them.
Great. Awesome. Well, Jeff, thanks again for coming on today. And for our listeners out there, to hear more stories like this, you can subscribe to this podcast. We are all over the web on Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and on our main website at smanewstoday.com. You can follow us there and also connect with us on the SMA News Today forums. We would love to hear from you all. So I am your host, Kevin Schaefer, and thanks for listening. We will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. All of our podcast and flash briefings can be found on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. You can also find our podcast and flash briefings on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. And be sure to follow us on our Instagram and Facebook page as well. For SMA News Today, I'm Michael Morale, Multichannel Content Director.